Hi, this is Karina V. Hart, and you're listening to Hart Talks. Today is Tuesday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for calling in. I can see that we have some callers on the line, so thanks for calling in to listen. You can find me at karinabhart.com. That's where I talk about Hart Talks, and I have a blog there. I do some life coaching, spiritual mentorship, ceremonies, retreats, that kind of thing, so you can find out about my work there. You can also look at suncoastfirewalkcenter.com, which is my business in Florida, where I lead firewalk events throughout the winter. I'm also available to do firewalk events anywhere else in the country the rest of the year from like June until early October. So tonight I wanted to talk to you about my recent trip to Standing Rock camp up in North Dakota. Standing Rock, in case you don't know, the Sioux Nation Dakota tribe reservation up in North Dakota. There is an oil pipeline planned to go through some of their sacred land and under the Missouri River, right where they live. Their concern is that the pipe will break, and we are aware of many, many, many pipeline breaks in the United States. You can do a quick Google search and see there's been hundreds of them in the last couple of years. So we know that the pipelines aren't safe, they aren't fail-proof, and if the pipeline bursts, it's going to negatively impact the land, the animals, the birds, the people, and all of the drinking water, which served people, I think the number was 70,000 people down downstream. I'm probably underestimating that number. But the Missouri River is quite big, and lots of communities that are not Native American depend upon that water. The protests began, and I don't want to use the word protest because the people themselves are saying please refer to them as protectors rather than protesters. What they are doing is protecting the water, protecting their land, and they are doing that with prayerful demonstration, nonviolent demonstrations only, as well as petitioning the government and going to talk with the president, and they were at the UN last week. Anyways, people started to arrive at Standing Rock to in support of protecting the water. And a camp opened called Sacred Stone Camp, and then there was an overflow camp called Red Warrior Camp. When I had the call to go to North Dakota, and I don't mean someone called me on the phone and asked me to come to North Dakota, I mean I was learning about what was happening up there, and that Black Lives Matter had gone up in solidarity, and I think there was something about that piece of information of Indigenous people and the Black Lives Matter movement coming together that felt incredibly important, historic, powerful, like a spiritual nexus had somehow opened up there in North Dakota. And I would say after having been there, I still believe that to be true. So anyways, I got it in my head that I had to be there, and there wasn't a lot of choice left for me. This is something that happens every so often. Because of my spiritual practice, I will get sort of what I call marching orders. It's always, you know, a choice. I can choose to say no to those kinds of marching orders. Certainly, I have free will in the universe. And sometimes the pull is really, really strong, and this was just one of those times. I had no idea why I needed to go or what I hoped to accomplish there or what I would come away from. I just knew that it was important to go and bear witness and to be present. I'm not the kind of activist who shows up on front lines and puts my body on the line and is able to get arrested. I'm the parent of two kids. I'm the sole supporter. Getting myself arrested is not possible for me. So my activism happens in other ways. I'm somewhat of an armchair activist. I hope that I educate people through things I share both on social media and in my classes and in my mentorship programs. long story short, you know, I was on my way to Colorado already, and when I got there and spoke with my dear friend Jade, she and I sort of came up with a plan that we would do this together. She had all the camping gear, or most of it anyway, and we put out a call to our communities asking for monetary support, really without the gas money, without money in hand in case the car broke down, in case anything happened. We didn't feel comfortable going, and it was my idea. I didn't expect Jade to flip the bill, and I just didn't have the resources to make it possible. So we put the call out to our community, and I would say, I think it was within 3 days, there was $650 collected in my PayPal account. Say that came from about 20 to 30 people. So thank you very much for those of you who contributed to that. So Jade and I took off with my son, my 15-year-old kid, in the car. He's homeschooled, and I thought this was a historical moment that he should also witness. We really didn't have any idea what we were headed toward. You know, we were watching the posts that were happening from Standing Rock online, looking at their website and seeing what they had asked for donations. And we did put together a nice package of donations using the funds that people sent us. We got poise pads for the elders and lots of fabric for prayer ties and many coats and sweaters and snow pants and snow boots and such. So we headed on up there with that. You know, it's a long 14-hour drive. We arrived and, you know, sort of came around this bend, and there was the camp below on the hill. And there were hundreds of tents, army tents, pop-up tents, trailers, a good handful of teepees. We just were sort of astounded at how beautiful the site was. So we're getting ready to approach. There wasn't really a gate. I would say that there was some people were standing in the road directing traffic, and we assumed that those people would stop us and ask us who we were and what we were doing there, how long we would stay, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I had my wallet out. I was ready to show ID if asked for it, and surprise, surprise, we just came up to the person directing traffic, and they waved us in, and we said, where should we go if we want to camp? And he just sort of waved his arm, and he said, well, somewhere down there, you know, you might have to drive around a bit. So we pulled in, and we're following down the hill, and they were directing traffic because there was lots of people coming in. You know, there were probably a total of 50 cars trying to enter camp. Jane and I drove around. We found a spot. We put our tent up, and then we said, well, we should walk up the hill to what looked like sort of the heart of the camp, the hearth, lots of people around. There was a tent up there that said they were accepting donations. There was another tent that had a sign on it that said check-in, and another with a sign that said volunteers. So we thought, oh, great, we'll just go up there and, you know, we'll give them our donations and check in and sign up and do all of those things. And so here's where things started to get different, you know. Here's where culture shock began to set in. So this is really what I wanted to talk to you about tonight. Sorry it took so long on the backstory. So we approached the tent where they were accepting donations, and a woman stopped us and said, hey, what do you got there? You know, we told her what we had, and started to put some things where she was pointing, but the clothing, she said, you know, we need that right now. And she began to open up the bags. We had two of those big, huge space bags that you can fill, and then you suck the air out of them with a vacuum cleaner to make so that we could fit them in the car with all of our gear. She opened up the bags and started to hold up and sort of assess sizes and things like that. And, you know, within a couple minutes, there were probably six or seven people around, people trying on the clothing, asking questions, you know, do you know if you have this size or that size of something, people carrying away clothing. And, you know, Jade and I just were kind of looking at each other like, what's going on here, you know? And so it became obvious we weren't needed. We didn't have to hand out the items, and we just sort of walked away. And later on, we were having a conversation about those moments, and what we discussed was, if I were to bring those donations anywhere that I'm aware of in white culture, Goodwill, if I make donations there, I pull up to their back door, I ring the bell, someone comes out, they take the donations, they say, do you want a receipt for that, for your taxes? And then they take the donations inside and they process them, right? They take inventory. We have this many of this many of that. They have a system on how they price things, and then they resell them to the public. In other circumstances, those items may not be resold, but they would still be very carefully inventoried, sized. You would know how much of everything that you had. And then it would be distributed according to somebody, right? Somebody in charge would decide who got what, right? What Jade said was somebody would decide, you know, who is the most worthy or who is the most needing of the items. So what we saw it bear out throughout the rest of our stay, and that was that whatever was brought into camp, whatever was donated to camp, became the property of the entire camp. It didn't belong to us anymore. It wasn't for us to distribute, obviously. But no one at camp was going to distribute it either. It was available. If it was in the donation tent, it was available to be taken by whoever needed it. And there was nobody asking, who are you? Why do you need it? Right? Prove to us that you need it. Everything was just belongs to everyone. This is something I've never seen in my entire life, even in my family, right? You know, what was yours, and that is the case in the culture that we live in. So the next little jaunt was over to the check-in tent and the volunteer tent. So we went over to where the sign said check-in. There was nobody there. We went around the corner. There was nobody there. I peeked inside of the big tent that the sign was hung on, and I said, is this where we check in? And people inside the tent just looked at me like they didn't know what I was talking about. And somebody said, what did you ask? And I said, is this where we check in? We just arrived. And the sign says to check in. And she said, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. And so, again, you know, Jade and I were like, what is happening, you know? Because we did send word in advance. There was a place on the website to sort of say, this is who we are, this is where we're coming from, this is how long we'll stay, this is what work we're willing to do, here's our phone numbers. And so I guess we expected, like you do, right, that there would be someone there sort of saying, oh, yeah, we have your name on the list, right? And again, later on, Jade and I just, you know, it was very late at night. We were just sort of slap happy. And I said, oh, yeah, like, don't you have my reservation? Don't you know who I am? Didn't you know that we're coming, you know? And there was none of that. There was no one checking out the gate to see who was there. There was no one checking people in. There was just a sense of, like, if you're here, you're supposed to be here. And that's that. Wow, right? There were probably, when we arrived, about 1,200 people in camp, maybe 1,500 people. And yeah, nobody asked us for our ID. To me, that's a profound statement about the culture and trust, right? And trust. So the rules of the camp were no alcohol, no drugs, no weapons. But again, no one was checking to make sure that no one had weapons. It was assumed that if you were coming into camp, that you were respectful. So that's a beautiful thing. Next, we wanted to go sign up to volunteer our time, right? That's really what we went there for, was to help out wherever we could, without going to the front lines. You know, lots of people were going to the front lines, and lots of people needed to stay back and to cook and to feed people and to clean up and all of the things that make a camp that big run. So we couldn't find a sign-up sheet. Even though the sign said volunteer, right, there was no volunteer sheet. And having been an organizer of events for 20-something years, there is always a sheet, right, where you say sign up here and you better show up for what you sign up for. We asked someone, you know, how do we volunteer? And the person said, well, just ask what needs to be done. You said, okay, well, I'd like to work in the kitchen if possible, so how do I volunteer for the kitchen? And again, he said, go in the kitchen and ask somebody what needs doing. And that was that, you know. There was no sign-up sheet. Nobody was going to come find me if I didn't show up. So I walked into the kitchen, and I said, how can I help? And a woman was standing there, and she had, like, three cases, big cases of vegetables in her hands, and she said, go put these in the cooler. I said, I just got here. I don't know where the cooler is. Where is that? And she sort of waved in a general direction. I walked over in that general direction and started looking around for the cooler to put these vegetables in, and I couldn't find anything that looked like refrigeration to me. No refrigerators, no freezer units, no, not even like coolers, right? So I again stopped somebody and said, you know, where's the cooler? I have to put these vegetables away. And he laughed and he pointed behind me and he said, it's right there. And what was behind me was the trailer of an 18-wheeler trailer truck. This huge trailer was the cooler. So I managed to get that open with someone else's help and brought the vegetables inside. And, you know, this cooler was, it was cooled. It was running on a with a generator, but floor to ceiling, front to back, filled with food, you know. Here's what I thought to myself. There's no lock on the door. There's no lock on the door. Like, anybody can come in here and take whatever they want. And then it occurred to me, yes, anybody can come in here and take whatever they want. So I turned around, I was getting ready to leave, and some other guy comes up the steps to the cooler and says, hey, you got any hamburger rolls in there? And I said, I don't know. He said, well, let's find them. So we found him the pile of hamburger rolls, and out the door he went with 400 or so of them. And I stepped out of the cooler and closed it up and just walked away shaking my head and went back and worked in the kitchen for the evening. So I want to just stay on this topic for a minute around volunteerism and everything belonging to everyone. So when everything belongs to everyone, that means it's everyone's responsibility to make sure that everything gets done, right? And again, there's no volunteer sheet. There's nothing, nobody who's going to make sure, nobody's going to police a volunteer situation. So what I saw happen over the course of the days that we were there is announcements would be made on the PA system. For instance, a truck just came in from Michigan, from the casino up there owned by the such and such tribe, and they have delivered 2.5 tons of food. So we're going to need strong young men to get over behind the big cooler and start unpacking that truck. And what you would see was young men would just get up from whatever they were doing, and they would just run to the area and help until the job was done. You know, the wood, we just got a new delivery of wood, and we need that wood organized and stacked and split so that we have it for cooking, because everything they were cooking for that many people was being cooked on open fires. So we need strong young men to go over and split wood and start stacking it. And again, you would just see young men would run and go do that. Or we need some women down at the such and such a camp. They're building a teepee. They need you to hang the canvas. And the women would go. And this was really how everything operated. A call would go out that something was needed, and the need would be taken care of immediately. Immediately. There were some times that I noted, because I spent a lot of time in the kitchen, which was up in that hearth of the camp, and that's where the PA system was, and that's where the sort of communal fire was, and dancing and singing and drums and in the evening, and announcements all day. So every once in a while an announcement would be made, and they would say, "Hey, people, the kitchen needs help. If you're standing around, what are you doing? Find something to do." And, you know, pretty soon there would be nobody standing, just standing around, right? Everybody stayed busy all day. No one complained about being busy. Nobody complained about having to volunteer. And I just found it remarkable, because I'm not from that culture, because I'm from a culture where work is paid. And even though we're getting paid, we all complain about having to go to work in order to get paid, right? And yes, the culture operates on a completely different paradigm. But I also just was astounded at this communal effort and the idea that there was something larger than the individual, okay, more important than the individual's needs. That, again, whatever came into the camp belonged to everyone, and everyone had to cooperate and work to assure that the camp ran smoothly, that three meals and snacks were provided for. By the time we left, it was over 3,000 people. People who needed help with tents going up, that they got that help that they needed. Those who were going to the front lines to do activist work were fed. They noticed on our second day that there needed to be a school, that there were a lot of kids at the camp, and they weren't going to school. And so by the third day, you know, this sort of got floated around noontime on day two, and by the third morning, there was a school set up. There was a tent, there were supplies, there were people to teach. It was quite astounding. There was no, like, we have to have a subcommittee meeting, you know, and make these decisions. Something needed to be done, and it got done because it needed to happen for the community. As someone who's been an organizer in a subculture, you know, I guess I've always hoped that our subculture would ascribe to some of these values. And I think that we are very quick to talk about how we ascribe to these values, but how that plays out is very different. So as an organizer who's organized, you know, events for rituals, day-long rituals for 500 people where everyone had to be fed and all kinds of things needed to be done in order to make the event run smoothly, you know, what I saw often was people being pissed off that they had to volunteer or not showing up, you know, signing up because you're supposed to sign up, but not showing up. Being really upset if they were called on it. I've been to events where, you know, they had like a little flyer that went around in the morning and your name was published that, you know, you shirked off on your duties. I also saw whenever we said we would do a potluck and please bring something, please bring anything, you know, to make sure because we have 500 people to feed. You know, there were so many people who wouldn't bring anything. And I understand that sometimes for people, there's not anything to bring from home. That I understand. But these are people that I knew. I knew how they lived. And what I saw was just an entitlement to whatever was available and that they didn't have to chip in. So again, a very different paradigm around how to make a community work. In order for community to work, everybody has to work, not just some people. And everybody has to do it because they understand if you want something from this community, you have to give something from this community. I'm not even talking about dollars right now. I'm talking about energy. I'm talking about labor. I'm talking about gifting. I'm talking about donations. And I'm talking about tribe, really, right? But what we saw there was not one tribe of people. So this is important, too. When we arrived, the news was that there were 70-plus tribes who had come from all over the country to join in this effort to protect the sacred waters. By the time we left, over 200 tribes had arrived. We saw the camp empty out on Tuesday after the long weekend. I think it was Labor Day weekend. And then we saw an influx of tribes come over the coming days. So we saw people, we saw the tribe, the Inuits, come down from Alaska with on their boats, you know, with their boats behind their trucks. But when they processed into camp, they were sitting in their boats and singing. We saw the Aztec, we saw the Apache, the Diné, tribes I've never heard of. And every tribe was welcomed formally. People processed into the center of the hearth. Every evening, during dinner time, there was often entertainment. Different young people would get up. They would sing songs. They would tell jokes. They would rap, tell stories. And then dinner wound down. The singing and the drumming would begin. Ceremonial, ancient songs. Haunting songs. You know, we would just find a place to sit down and listen and watch. The people would come out and they would circle dance. Jade and I noted what was different and what was the same around pagan circle dances and drumming. What I also noticed was when women spoke or when women got up to the microphone on the PA system and either and spoke or prayed or sang, that everyone stopped what they were doing. People stopped in the track. If people were sitting down, they stood up. And all attention, all focus, honor, and respect was given to the women. It was very, very powerful. So as I turn my focus, I want to talk a little bit about women at the camp. As we were preparing to go, gathering the funds and the camping gear and all of the things that we needed to go, I started to follow this woman on Facebook who was posting dispatches from Standing Rock. The dispatches were beautifully, passionately, poetically written, and she was writing about the women gathering every morning to go down to the river and pray for the water, to pray at the water. Women carrying their prayers from all over the country, women weeping at the water, and I thought, I have to see that, I have to go there. So the first morning that we were there, we were sort of looking around for where those women might be, where they might be gathering, and noticed a little circle of women gathering together, sort of walked by, and we're looking, and they said, oh, come here, come here. And you're looking to pray with the women at the water, and we said, yes, yes. So we walked down to the water from the main camp, singing, praying, and what I saw along the way was every man who we passed stopped in his tracks and gave us his full attention and respect. And I just started weeping. I had never experienced anything like that. You know, even as a priestess in my own communities, never experienced that level of honor for the voice of women. Very powerful. So we went down to the river and we prayed. It was quite moving, quite beautiful, wading in the river up to our knees through mud, helping one another into the water, making offerings, making prayers. And then we headed back together toward the council fire, and we were told by the woman who was leading us that this was the first time that we had been, that the women had been invited to carry their prayers to the council fire, which was not that hearth place that I have been talking about, but outside the teepee that had many tops to it. I don't know how to describe it, but it was like a long house made of canvas and teepee poles. And I was told that within that teepee was where the seven council fires were gathered for the first time in over a century. So outside of that was a fire that was burning when we arrived, and the women circled around and made one more prayer, leaving, putting offerings in the fire. Then we were invited to go to the women's camp, which was just a little ways away from where we were standing. We arrived there, and the women there were sort of flustered and were just getting their camp put together. Said, come back at like 5 o'clock this afternoon. We'll be ready to have some kind of meeting. We left, and we went, and we volunteered for the day. You know, Jane and I, we didn't say much to each other. I think we were both thinking about what had transpired in the morning, but what struck me immediately when we first found that circle of women is that they were all white. They were all, they were not from camp. They were not from the tribes. Later, we found that many of the women could name Native ancestry, but they were all from our culture. You know, what I wanted to bring up here, and, you know, I still feel like it would be better for me to write about this stuff, but there's so much to tell, and my world is still sort of reeling on its axis as a result of what I saw and participated in and experienced at Standing Rock, that it's been really impossible for me to sit down and write about it in a coherent way. So it's just sort of coming out in spurts and bursts when I speak to people and, you know, in little posts on Facebook or my blog. But I wanted to address what I saw happening at Standing Rock. I'm not going to name names, and I'm not going to say that every woman who was part of that camp or part of the women morning prayers had this opinion or these biases, but I feel it's really, really important to point this out. What I saw was women who were obviously pagan, who had obviously been trained in women's mysteries, women's ways of magic, the kinds of magic that I as a woman learned, you know, back in the 1990s, goddess spirituality, feminist paganism, women's bodies and women's womb and particular ways that women should move in the world and how we should be treated based upon perceived history of a time when cultures were matriarchal. What I saw was a desire to create a women's only space within this larger sacred space. They wanted to create a space that was safe for women to come based upon the reality that there is a lot of domestic violence in Native culture. There's a lot of domestic violence in non-Native culture. I just want to say that as well. And they wanted to provide a safe space for that. They also wanted to just have a place where women could come and just be women. Out of this very quickly arose the idea that there needed to be a womb space, a red tent, a moon lodge for women to go and bleed. And there was a lot of talk during that conversation about women not having a voice in Lakota culture, that the men were the decision makers and they overpowered women, that there was a sign on the front lines, and it is traditional in Lakota culture to prohibit women who are bleeding to enter the sweat lodge. It's taboo. They have their reasons. What was happening on the front lines for the water protectors was prayer. And so there was a sign there as well asking women, if you're on your blood, to please not participate. And this really had the hackles up of these white women, and I'm calling them white women because they come from white culture. They were trained in white culture. I know who some of their teachers were. I understand where the red tent came from. So what I saw here was these women saying that they thought it was oppressive that women could not be part of certain ceremonies well on their moon time, and that they really wanted to educate these Native women about how this was a colonialist, patriarchal idea that had come with the white man to their land. So there's a way that, you know, you can look at that and you can say, yeah, I don't know how I feel about the prohibition of women who are on their moon time being in lodge or partaking in particular rites. However, for me as a white woman to come into this culture that I don't live in, that I don't understand, that I have not been raised in, and presume that I know better about what women in that culture need than those women know, is the epitome of colonialization, is the epitome of patriarchal thought. And I just don't understand how that forcing second wave white feminist thought into this environment was helpful, thoughtful, sacred. I thought it was really, really wrongheaded. And I've been carrying that in my chest for weeks. So it feels good to get it off my chest. It feels good to have that heard. But I think it's something for us to think about as more and more people I see from our communities are heading out to Standing Rock. I think it's very important that we go there to learn rather than to teach them what we think we know. What did I learn at Standing Rock? Aside from the communal property, the sharing economy, the volunteer economy, what I learned there was prayer. I'm a pretty spiritual person. I've been practicing my path for a couple decades now. I have a daily practice. I live a rather cloistered, almost monastic lifestyle when I'm not traveling to teach. And yet, the prayer that I witnessed was different than anything I've experienced or ever seen. And the understanding of what prayer means was really, really different than what I have ever been exposed to before. So what I saw was that prayer is an all-day, every-day event, that every interaction is a prayer. So the idea that water is sacred, that's really the idea that pulled me to Standing Rock. I live near the ocean. I have to live near the water. I have to live near ocean water, salt water that moves, big water. Part of my spiritual path to be near the water. The deities that I am dedicated to, that I consider to be my patrons, are water goddesses. So water is sacred, water is life, was a clarion call, right? And I think that what I want to try to express, it's so hard to express in words yet, is that it isn't the idea that water is sacred, but the reality that water is sacred. Not the idea, not the concept, not the symbol, but the thing itself. And water is sacred, water is life. And that our connection to the earth is sacred, not in a way that we talk about or think about, but a reality, the reality that I saw being lived on a daily basis. You know, the earth, air, fire, and water, the ancestors, the elders, the old ones, the children, and the voices of women were deeply, deeply respected and honored. Not as a concept, not as concepts, not as something you learned how to do or were trying to figure out, but as a reality. And I understand that we get this, that lots of spiritual people get this, but I think that there's a lived experience that we don't get because we don't live in a culture that upholds those beliefs, okay? Everywhere we look in our culture, those beliefs are shattered. We have to take part in so many activities during our day in order to live in this culture, activities which deny the reality that we believe these earth, air, fire, and water to be sacred. I don't know that I'm expressing clearly, powerfully enough what I experienced there. But I did promise that I would come back and I would share what those experiences were, what I came away with. The one other thing that I wanted to address before I close, and I don't have very much longer to talk, so, is the understanding that what is happening at Standing Rock is not some faraway thing. That the people who are there are not protecting the water because it is only in their interest to do so, okay? They are protecting the water because all water is sacred and that they understand that the water that affects their life affects all the people downstream. And the Missouri then dumps into the Mississippi, so all of those people as well. We see, a week ago, a state of emergency in Georgia because of a natural gas spill. We saw here in Florida a week ago hundreds and hundreds of millions of gallons of toxic waste stored in a pool fertilizer company, and a sinkhole opened up underneath that pool, and that toxic waste is now in the aquifer. That aquifer provides water for 2/3 of the state, and that water is radioactive. It's poison. But that was just a blip on the 5 o'clock news. We know of the big oil spills, right? BP and Exxon Valdez and Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico and over here and over there, all of these oil spills, this is all affecting our water. Meanwhile, you know, we have droughts. Meanwhile, Nestle is pumping water into bottles as fast as it can because they understand that there is going to be tremendous profit to be made when we cannot and will not drink the water that's coming out of our taps because our pipes are rusty, because our pipes have lead in them, because the water is poison, because there's a drought. The one thing that I saw at Standing Rock that was really upsetting to me was the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of bottles of water. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of bottles of water. And I don't know what the solution to that is because there is no running water at the camp. But here we are praying for the water, and here there's a movement against this oil pipeline that carries petroleum, and all of these bottles are created. You know, they're plastic bottles. Plastic is from petroleum. So what I was saying was that, we have a hard time in our day-to-day lives, hard to hold the values that we say we hold dear when we're confronted with so many ways that we must, in order to survive, treat the earth, the air, the fire, and the water as though they are not sacred. To treat one another as though we are not sacred. What I saw was a communal acceptance. Whoever came into that camp was welcomed. And in fact, they are still putting out a call saying, we need more people to come. Just get in your car, and if there's any way to get here, do so. They need more people. So there's that. If you can go, go. But I want to just talk about what's happening on the other side of that is an open invitation, not only to come and support what they are doing, but an open invitation to join in their community, to learn from their ceremonies, to eat with them and work with them. And this is an opportunity, I think, for education. It's a wake-up call. Coming home to Florida, to my little tiny apartment where I live with my kid, and I may go 4 or 6 or 8 weeks sometimes before I see a face that I recognize because we live alone, right, in a place where we don't know people. But even in a place where we did know people, sometimes 2 and 3 and 4 weeks would go by before I saw a face that I knew was a friend, right? And this is how we're trying to live. This is why we're all so scared. This is why we're all holding on to our stuff. But I have to tell you, the time is upon us now where we have to learn how to live together, because it's not working for any of us to be living apart in our own isolated little units, working and working and working just to keep that roof over our head and food on the table. We have to remember how to support one another physically, financially, with food and community and shelter and shared resources. If I came away from Standing Rock with anything that I want to share with my communities, with the people who care anything about what I have to say, it's that the time of trying to do it ourselves is over. And if that isn't clear to you yet, I suspect it will be clear to you soon. I've listened to our communities talk about communal living for 25 years. I've heard, first we have to have the money. Well, it's 25 years and we still don't have the money. Because we don't know how to share our money, right? We don't know how to share resources. So the story has been, first we need the money, then we need to buy land, then we need to build something on the land, then we need to make sure only the people that we like live on the land with us, and then we need to make rules and sanction behavior so that no one is ever offended once we live together. And I think we're going to die alone, people. It's kind of a brutal thing to say, but it's true. We don't have the resources for all of that, nor do we have the time. It's also been 25 years since we recognized, or since I recognized anyway, something is coming. We better get ready. And in the 1990s, we were preparing. We didn't know what we were preparing for. People were getting spiritual training. People were getting trained as alternative healers. People were getting trained as community leaders. People were getting trained as, how to build houses and how to live off the grid and how to grow our own food and how to slaughter animals and how to hunt, all of these skills. But we didn't know why. We didn't know what was coming. We just knew something was. And so now we're here. The something coming isn't coming. We're in it. We're right in the middle of it. And the one thing we forgot to do is learn how to take care of each other really, really well. So this may sound like an admonition, and maybe it is, but I suggest that if you're planning on moving soon, move in with somebody. If you know somebody who's looking to move and they're having a hard time and they don't know how they're going to do it, invite them to come stay with you. Get a bigger apartment together. Rent a house together. Rent land together. Rent a rent-to-own place together. Take over an apartment building in the city. Take over the houses on the street. One by one by one. And failing all of that, at least show up and feed one another. Who's cooking tonight? Everybody brings something. I tried to do this 5 years ago. People said, this is too much trouble. It's too much trouble to feed one another. Too hard for my schedule. I have to work twice as hard to cook for this many people. But the time is now. So those of you who are organizers, organize. Those of you who are teachers, teach. Bring your skills, because this is what we've been preparing for, and it's here. And if you still don't know how we're supposed to do it, I suggest you send an emissary to Standing Rock. Send them for a week and let them come back and teach you what they learned. Because it isn't about making sure everybody gets along and everyone is comfortable. It isn't about making sure that everyone has their own private little privacy or that everyone has their own stuff. So yes, water is sacred. The earth is sacred. Air and fire are sacred, as are our ancestors, as are our elders, as are our children, as are your lovers and your brothers and your sisters and your wives and husbands and the person at the shop who's bringing your groceries through. Let's try to live the things that we say, that we believe in. We can still do better. That's all I got for you tonight, people. I really do love you. I hope you feel that in my heart. And I'm making prayers for all of us. Good night now.